The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow today.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, on this Wednesday, July 3rd, doing the monthly spot for Jeff Davis. Today, I am very excited to say we have a special guest, famed underwater photographer, Brian Scarry. First, before we speak with Brian, we'll be talking with Lila Nori. Lila has done an array of international expertise in natural resource conservation and is the executive director of Hawaii Conservation Alliance. Welcome to the show, Lila.
Thank you so much for having us today, Carly.
Thank you. And you are going to be a very busy girl in the next couple of weeks. You are putting on the Hawaii Conservation Conference.
That's right. It's our 21st annual Hawaii Conservation Conference. The theme this year is Living Today, Sustaining Tomorrow, Connecting People, Places, and Planet.
Wow, that's a mouthful. How did you come up with that theme?
Well, science and managers have been scratching their heads for years wondering how can we really affect change. And I think in the last 5 and 10 years, we've realized that it involves people and involves connecting people to their place and that place to the planet largely. And so it's all about connecting people to planet this year. And that's, you know, shown in all of presentations and our keynote speakers, our special events. We really want to make it relevant to people who live here, who use the resources, who eat the food that's grown from the land and fish from the sea.
And can you give us a little bit of a preview of what to expect? What kind of keynote speakers do you guys have?
Well, for keynote speakers, we have an international speaker named Dr. Doug Mackenzie Moore. He's actually from Canada, and he's an expert in community-based social marketing. And so he'll be sharing with the audience how to actually affect behavior change in our communities. We also have our very own Neil Hannes from Kamehameha Schools, who's going to talk about we are who we are because of where we are, and have this cultural spin, Native Hawaiian cultural spin on conservation and management. So we're really excited about that. And then a really special feature on Wednesday is having this cross-sector afternoon where we'll be talking about building partnerships for a sustainable future. And we're inviting the public and cross-sectors to join us for free, actually, the entire Wednesday, where Hawaii Green Growth will be sponsoring Bright Spots in Conservation.
So what kind of events can the public participate in this program?
Well, certainly Wednesday, July 17th, from 1 o'clock all the way till 8:30, they're welcome to come and participate in the forums and discussion, interactive sessions. But definitely in the evening at 5:30, we have this real special pahana. It's actually called Kupa Ai Kako, which means native-born long attached to a place. And what we're trying to do is create this multi-sensory Native Hawaiian experience where through sight, touch, hearing, smell, and taste, we bring Native Hawaiian culture to you and mix that into what we're trying to do to preserve and protect Hawaii.
That's amazing. And in 21 years, I mean, that's a long time. How do you guys keep coming up with new themes and fresh ideas?
That's a good question. I guess I would say that certainly the Hawaii Conservation Alliance has been around, you know, since the 80s. And through that time, conservation itself has really changed its face. It's broadened. It's less about science, more about people. Because, you know, what good is having a healthy resource if you don't have people being able to support and use it? And so I think that as conservation's changed, we've been able to come up with the themes because they're changing at the same time. So the last 5 years, you'll see a lot more integration, a lot more Mauka Makai you know, themes and things like that.
And the sessions are quite diverse, too. I mean, you've got marine themes, also invasive species, land use. Who should be interested in this conference and why should they come?
I feel like for the conference, students who are interested in joining the field, so the next generation, definitely. Cross-sector professionals for that special afternoon, folks who are in energy, who are in water, who are in the see the food security sector and even energy, agriculture, they should all come and figure out how we can find that intersection together, because we know that fish have no boundaries and the forest is, you know, supporting all of us through its water provision. So, you know, there's collaboration that needs to happen across sectors, not just between federal, state, and community resource managers. And so I'm thinking if all of those people showed up to this Hawaii Green Growth event on Wednesday afternoon, we'd be able to come up with some solutions where we could work together with the private sector and public sector.
That's amazing. And so where can people go to find out more information if they want to sign up for the full conference or one day of the conference?
Absolutely. We have some special rates also for nonprofits, for students, and for Pacific Islanders. So if you go to our website, www.hawaiiconservation.org, all of the information is there and how you could get involved, whether it's just the community event or the whole conference, or even just wanting to get involved in conservation.
And what days is the conference taking place, most importantly?
July 16th through 18th. So July 16th, 17th, 18th is the conference, which is in 2 weeks about.
And that's at the Convention Center.
It is, Convention Center in Honolulu.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like to share about the upcoming conference? Anything we should know about? Any surprise speakers or anything like that?
We don't have any surprise speakers scheduled that I didn't talk about already, but we do want you to come and sort of open your mind and realize it's not really going to be about science and management only. This year's conference is going to be really relevant and interesting to a wide variety of people.
I'm really excited. I've gone to a bunch of the conferences in the past, and it's always a really good networking opportunity, and there's always really interesting talks. So I think it's going to be a fantastic year for you guys.
And we can't wait to hear you speak too, Carly. I know you're presenting on Spinner Dolphins, so very exciting.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and we want to hear all about how it goes too. I know you, next month we're going to have someone from Hawaii Conservation Alliance come on and give us a little tidbit about what happened in a report out. So we look forward to hearing that.
Thank you so much for having us, Carly. Aloha.
Aloha. So coming up next, we have Brian Scarry, as I mentioned, from National Geographic. And this is kind of a big deal because Brian is been definitely someone who I've looked up to for quite some time. I've had the pleasure of spending a few days with him and have gotten to see how he works and seen some of his photographs live. He just came out with a new book, I think, in the past year called Ocean Soul. Brian, quickly, before we dive into really the meat and potatoes of our talk today, why don't you tell us a little bit about what this book is like?
Well, thanks, Carly. It's a real pleasure to be here. And yeah, the book, Ocean Soul, I sort of informally refer to as a mid-career retrospective. I'd like to think I still have a number of years ahead of me here, but it was a collection of my favorite photographs and stories over the last 15 years that I've been working for National Geographic and realistically the last 35 years that I've been exploring the world's oceans with a camera. So I've picked my favorite images and I've written the text to accompany that to go with you know, what it's like to be a National Geographic photographer, what it's like to be out in the field, and mostly what it's like to, you know, encounter and experience these animals, whether it's tiger sharks in the Pacific or the Bahamas, or harp seals under the ice in Canada, leatherback turtles in the Caribbean, or all these other engaging creatures that I've had the privilege to spend time with around the world. So bringing readers sort of up close and personal with these animals, along with the adventures that sort of go with that.
Well, and the adventures speak for themselves, but I mean, the pictures stand alone, tell a story. I mean, these are not just your run-of-the-mill wildlife pictures. I mean,
well, thanks.
They are just riveting and really bring to life what you do. Is there a particular favorite in the book?
Huh. Well, that's a good question. Yeah, there's many that I really remember fondly and that I like for different reasons, but if I had to answer that question, I might cheat a little bit and say that there's probably two favorite photographs for very different reasons. A lot of my work these days is sort of a blend of what I call celebratory photography, where I'm going into the ocean and trying to make pictures that really celebrate the magnificence of what we see down there. And on the other hand, I shoot images that are more issue-based, you know, that I try to show some of the problems that are occurring in our world's oceans, so that people have a better sense of a complete picture of what's happening. So in regards to your question, One of my favorite pictures is a celebratory image of my assistant standing on the bottom of the ocean next to a 45-foot, 70-ton southern right whale. This was a story I did for National Geographic magazine about right whales, and I went on a very speculative trip to the subantarctic of New Zealand to try to photograph a newly discovered population. Speculative because I didn't know if the animals would, you know, be friendly, if they would let me get close, if the visibility would be good, all of those things. But it worked out extremely well, and I was able to make this one photograph that has gotten a lot of coverage, where my assistant is, in fact, standing very close. And, you know, I think for that reason, because of the human presence, because he's standing on the bottom, it's this giant whale next to a small human. It sort of resonates with people that see it. So that's sort of one of my favorites on that end. The other end, I would say that there was a picture I made of a thresher shark in a gill net that was dead, and it sort of looked like a crucifixion. And so in terms of issues and problems in the ocean, that sort of represents the other side of the coin.
That's amazing. And seriously, go Google this whale picture because it is unbelievable. Brian, I'm so excited to talk more with you about all the experiences you've had. I mean, with over 10,000 hours underwater. Brian Scarry, we're going to take a quick traffic break. And when we come back, we are going to learn more about your amazing experiences.
Okay.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
No new accidents or stalls are reported. Traffic's normal for your afternoon commute, and it's probably going to be a little faster because of the light summertime traffic and the fact that tomorrow's a holiday. If you're going west, the H1 slows at the west end of the airport viaduct. The Moana Lewis slows at the 4th Chapter overpass. Inbound traffic slows on both freeways as you approach the Middle Street merge. No problems to the windward side or Hawaii Kai.
Aloha, the solar guy Jeff Davis here again. Do you want a free solar system? How about free 5 panels? How about a free trip to Vegas? How about free 15,000 Hawaiian miles? Oh, I know what you want. Free financing. Well, then don't call me. As the old saying goes, there is no free lunch. It's as easy as a phone call. Just give me a call, and we'll be talking about your photovoltaic or your solar hot water. You'll be getting an impeccable installation. We have a 10-year workmanship warranty. We don't subcontract. We've had an electrical license here on Oahu for 25 years. We don't have to cut corners on the quality of our equipment, and our pricing is unbeatable due to the fact that we have no overhead. I, the solar guy, will personally design your system by maximizing tax credits, often a 2-year process. By calling us, Kamiyama Solar Electric, and me personally, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, the only thing you'll get for free is aloha. Give me a call, 554-7200, a solar guy at 554-7200, and I want to tell you, aloha.
Listen to Hawaii Money Resource every weekday at 2 p.m. with Marco Muscovich. Tune in to hear interviews with various Hawaii businesses, financial do's and don'ts, and much more. It's Hawaii Money Resource every weekday at 2 p.m. with Marco Muscovich.
The sun is the root source of energy in food, fossil fuels, and wind energy. The clearest use of the sun's energy is solar power. BanQu Solar brings to Hawaii a technological breakthrough that maximizes the power from each solar module. With our AC Unison system, BanQ Solar's AC Unison modules have microinverters on each module that converts DC electricity to AC electricity, allowing your system to produce 5 to 25% more power than other solar systems. It's cost-effective, has a 25-year warranty and an attractive all-black design. The AUO BenQ Solar Company is one of the most trusted companies in the solar industry. With state and federal incentives in place and utility rates going up, now is the time to generate your own electricity with a beautiful BenQ solar system. It looks great, produces more power than standard solar systems, and saves you money in the process. Call 554-7200 for your local BenQ solar installer and enjoy your savings now.
Over the past century, more than 90% of koa forests in Hawaii have disappeared as tropical hardwood prices have skyrocketed. Hawaii's koa forests are an important part of our ecosystem and a symbol of our island heritage. Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Hawaii's Tomorrow need your help to repopulate 1,000 acres on the Big Island with new koa trees. For $60, you can sponsor your very own koa legacy tree on the slopes of Mauna Kea. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Along with a beautifully engraved personalized certificate, $20 will also be donated to the charity or organization of your choice. Gift a gift that grows grander year after year. And see how simple the act of planting a tree can change the face of the planet. To plant your Hawaiian Koa Legacy Tree, go to hawaiistomorrow.com and click on the Legacy Tree icon. Again, hawaiistomorrow.com. That's Hawaii's with an S, tomorrow.com.
Aloha nohoi kako and ho mai kai nohoi praise to really Jeff listen. Davis.
You're terrible.
I'm terrible.
I love you, Ruby. Aloha.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. And with us today is Brian Scarry, underwater photojournalist with National Geographic. Brian, I am so, so excited you're here today. We just talked a little bit about your recent book, Ocean Soul. But what got you started in shooting underwater photography?
Well, you know, I started as a diver first. I suppose, like so many people of my generation, was inspired by documentaries by Jacques Cousteau. And as a child, I read National Geographic magazine and just wanted to be one of those ocean explorers. So when I was old enough, I guess about age 15, I started scuba diving. And it was maybe a year or two after that, I actually attended a diving conference near my home in Boston, a show called the Boston Sea Rovers. And I can remember sitting in the audience, you know, as this teenager and watching all these underwater photographers and documentary filmmakers present their work. And I had somewhat of an epiphany where I realized that this was the perfect career for me, where I could explore the ocean but do it with a camera. So beginning then, I guess at about 16 or 17, I had this quest to become a National Geographic photographer, which was a lofty goal for a kid from a little blue-collar working-class town in Massachusetts. But it eventually happened.
And you started off mostly doing shipwreck stuff. How did that transition to wildlife for you?
Yeah, well, I did. You're right. That's true. But it was more because that's what was available to me. You know, when I started diving, I didn't have the resources to travel around the world. I was very interested in natural history. I wanted to dive with dolphins and sharks and photograph all those kinds of things. But growing up where I did, there was certainly wildlife, but there was also a lot of shipwrecks. And that also intrigued me. So I started working on charter boats locally and did a lot of North Atlantic wreck diving. You know, I did the Andrea Doria a dozen times. I dove and photographed a number of submarines, German U-boats, things like that, and sort of cut my teeth on this very challenging kind of diving, but always with the intent of moving into natural history when I had the resources to do so. I mean, I was certainly photographing wildlife in New England at the same time. But as I got a little bit older, started to make a few bucks, I began traveling and shooting worldwide on wildlife as well.
And before the traffic break, we were talking about your book, Ocean Soul. Hmm. And you sort of talked about these two images. I asked you what your favorite images were in the book. And to me, I think that really articulates why your work is so important. You said, you know, this famous whale shot that just shows the awe and beauty and size. Mm. But then you also said about this entanglement photograph you have.
Right.
And so I think, you know, your work really hovers along the beauty of the wildlife, but also showing some of the more serious issues. And how do you get that across to your fans and to your readers?
Well, you know, let me say first that sort of happened not by my planning, but sort of by serendipity. I, like most photographers, I suppose, when I first started, just wanted to make beautiful pictures of the subjects that interested me. But there was somewhat of an evolution in my career in that over time, I began to see a lot of problems occurring in our world's oceans, degradation to ecosystems and vanishing species. So as a journalist, I felt sort of a sense of duty and responsibility and a sense of urgency to begin covering those issues as well. And fortunately, those story ideas were embraced by National Geographic. When I went to them and said, you know, I want to do a story on the global fish crisis, or I want to do a story on endangered underwater species, they really embraced that and supported me 100%. So in terms of the coverage, I think it's important to try to not beat people over the head with just doom and gloom. We have to be able to show these difficult pictures. You know, a lot of what I try to do is approach these subjects as a war photographer might do. It's different than traditional underwater photography. I'm out there trying to make pictures that might be a little more disturbing, that really show what's happening. But then I also want to show the good side. You know, I want to show, you know, the leatherback turtle in a beautiful setting on a beach or swimming underwater, but then I've made pictures of them in gill nets as well, or, you know, bycatch from a shrimp boat coming down underwater. So those disturbing photographs, but then also offer solutions. I think it's very important, and that's a big part of what National Geographic wants to do as well, is not just talk about the bad news, but then what can we do about it? So whether it's marine protected areas or better management of some of these species, we try to show the other side too.
And I think you walk that balance very well, and it's not an easy thing to do. And, you know, Nat Geo is a very popular magazine and has a very good reputation and has continued to keep that reputation for so long. What do you think it is about the magazine, or maybe you have insight in working for that magazine, that keeps it sort of that step above a lot of the other photojournalist magazines?
That's a great description. And, you know, even though I work for National Geographic, I'm also a great fan of the work that my colleagues do there. And, you know, I would say from my perspective, I never cease to be amazed by the dedication that the people that work there have. You know, I can understand myself or my colleagues that do other stories as photographers being very passionate about whatever story they're working on. You know, if I'm working on a shark story, I'm very passionate about that, or my colleagues working on a snow leopard story or whatever. But the people inside are equally as passionate. You know, when we bring in those images, my editor has to go through every single picture. So on a typical assignment these days, I might shoot 40 or 50,000 frames, 40 or 50,000 pictures. And the Geographic is very religious about how we do that. We have to shoot, if we're shooting digital, we have to shoot raw files. We have to turn in a hard drive in sequence. We're not allowed to delete photographs. They want to make sure everything is pure. So my editor has to go through 50,000 pictures to find the best images. And then I'll work with her to sort of edit that down to maybe 12 that we end up publishing, depending on the size of the story. But every step of the way, the people inside are passionate. The designers, the layout editors, the picture editors, all these people take ownership of the story. They get deeply involved in the research. And I think it shows, as you said, you know, I think they can continue to stay very fresh. They continue to stay current. And it's really a testament these days to the editor-in-chief, Chris Johns, who was a staff photographer at one point, but he really wants to keep that magazine on the cutting edge from the photography, the writing, at every level, the editing. And I think it shows, you know, they've continued to win magazine awards year after year after year and really do set sort of a gold standard.
It's amazing. And, I mean, equally as passionate and meticulous with their work is you are. I mean, I've seen it firsthand. And what makes you decide a story? So you pitch a story to Nat Geo. What piques your interest when you're like, okay, this is what I want to do. This is a story I'm going to pitch.
Well, you know, that's also a really great question because, you know, I think a lot of people think that the photographers that work for the magazine just get assignments, like a newspaper photographer perhaps, and you just go out and do a job. But it's really not that way. Almost every story that I've ever done has indeed been a story that I proposed. And the ideas come to me simply by the things that interest me. So in the early days, you know, when I was just wanting to do celebratory stories, I just picked subjects that I was fascinated with, you know, a particular marine animal or a place in the world that I wanted to go and explore. And, you know, got the support to do that. These days, it's still the same. You know, I'm sort of driven by species and things that interest me. I do try to balance that with a conservation theme oftentimes. I look for those more journalistic sides of stories. And you know, I might want to do a story on, you know, whales, a specific species of whale. So I'm very interested in just making dramatic images of that species of whale, but I'll also, in my research, try to see if there's, you know, some threats. Are there conservation issues? Are there environmental issues that we need to be aware of and try to tell as complete a story as possible? So The research will often last more than a year before I ever go out into the field, and then I might work on it for a year or two, sometimes over, you know, a period of weeks during that period.
Amazing. Well, I hope our listeners are as intrigued and as interested as I am in not only your work, but the makings of a story. Let's chat about that a little bit after we take a traffic break and acknowledge some of our sponsors, R&R Solar and Rolf Christ, Edible Hawaiian Islands, Natural Energy Lab, Honolulu Weekly, and Sabrina's Restaurant.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
No problems going east to Hawaii Kai or over to the windward side on the H3, the Likelike, or the Pali. We do have some slow traffic going west, though. The H1 slows at the Hickam Curve. The Moanalua slows right after Middle Street. It's going to be slow until you get out past the Waimalu Pearl City exit. Got one new accident. It's out on the leeward coast near the Waianae Mall, Farrington Highway at Lehoku Street.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis. You know, I'm offering you folks a chance to get an education, this time about on-bill financing. You've heard about the new bill the governor signed, paying for your photovoltaic system on your electricity bill. As you may know, the governor just signed this revolutionary bill, and it is directed and aimed at folks that have no ability to find the upfront money for their photovoltaic purchase. If you have questions, you can always call me or attend my seminar. Get a hold of me at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. And aloha.
280,000 acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kahoolawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha. I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms. And this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opilioahu.com.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to my dad, the solar guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. With us now is Brian Skerry, National Geographic underwater photojournalist. So, Brian, we've been kind of picking your brain a little bit about the process that goes on into putting together a story. What are you working on right now?
Well, I am working on two new stories. Actually, I've got three upcoming next year that are scheduled for publication. One that I finished on aquaculture and mariculture, a story that sort of looks at the latest and greatest methods of, you know, farming fish around the world. I've also sort of in the middle of, almost winding up on a story about bluefin tuna, amazing, you know, biological creature we have in our world's oceans. This is the North Atlantic bluefin tuna that I'm looking at. And sort of just getting underway with a story about dolphins and dolphin cognition, which is scheduled to be a cover story next November.
Excellent. And is that what brings you to Hawaii?
It is indeed. Yeah, that's why I'm here, to spend a little time with some of the local spinner dolphins and see if we can make a few pictures that will reveal to readers a little bit about their world.
Excellent. And have you gone out to see some of the spinner dolphins yet? Have you seen what's going on out there?
Yeah, I have. Only a brief glimpse the last couple of 3 days. But it's been beautiful. You know, the moments that I did have with these animals were wonderful. And I'm hoping to have a lot more in the remaining time.
And you've explored dolphins elsewhere in the globe as well. What else have you looked at?
Yeah, well, you know, my story is really going to be a blend. Because we're looking at cognition, it's really a blend of wild behaviors along with some captive research that's happening with some leading researchers around the world. So I've been in places like Patagonia, Argentina. I was in Honduras recently, in Florida, and have several other locations upcoming over the next year. It's a pretty ambitious coverage plan, But so far it's going well. And I think, you know, it'll give readers a real glimpse into these big brains in the sea. You know, what are these animals doing with that big brain, second only to humans in terms of, you know, body size to brain size. And it's been a long time since we've done a big dolphin story in the magazine, so I think it's a perfect time to sort of look at the latest and greatest info out there that's happening.
Well, I'm definitely biased, but you can never get enough dolphin.
Well, you should be biased, yeah.
And so tell us, you have all these stories you pick, and you've done a balance of conservation and animal interest stories. What to you is the most pressing marine conservation issue to date?
Boy, that is a difficult, you know, question to answer, because there are so many problems. You know, I've often said that the oceans are dying a death of a thousand cuts. I think the ocean is very resilient and has the ability to restore itself and heal itself, but there's such an onslaught these days. You know, some of the issues that I think rise to the top include things like overfishing. I did a story, it was a cover story in 2007, about the problems of commercial industrialized overfishing. This was driven really because of two things. You know, over my career, I had seen far fewer fish in the places I used to see a lot of fish. I saw less sharks in the places I used to see sharks. But I also read a scientific paper back around that time that was published in the journal Nature, a British journal, that stated that 90% of the big fish in the ocean have disappeared in the last 60 years post-World War II because of industrialized commercial overfishing. And, you know, this was referring to the billfish, the sharks, and the tunas. And when I read that, I thought, you know, this is going to be headline news in every media outlet. We've lost 90% of the big fish in the ocean, but it really didn't get that much attention. So I set out to do this story that would show readers some of the problems. You know, it's not like other things that we eat. This is the mass harvesting of wildlife. It's really the only big way that we still harvest wildlife on the planet. And yet, in many places, it's done in unsustainable ways. It's done in very destructive ways, you know, bottom trawlers and gill nets and long lines and some of these things. So I just wanted readers to have a sense of what we eat when it comes to seafood, which is a sort of a bad term as well. I'd rather think of the creatures that live in the ocean as marine wildlife and not food. But anyway, that's one of the big issues for me. But there's so many. You know, there's acidification, there's sea level rise, there's coral reef die-off because of temperature rise. A lot of these things I've covered in recent stories, but those are some of the top ones for me.
And those are really important. And I guess, you know, focusing on conservation photography at least allows you to share some of those stories.
It does. You know, I'm privileged in the sense that National Geographic is read by, I guess, 50 or 60 million people worldwide in so many countries. And it's a
small number, right?
It's just a small number, yeah. But it's a great platform to sort of begin talking about these issues. And there really is no other source, no other print magazine, and online, and with the tablet editions these days, that can do so many stories of varied interest. You know, it's sort of considered a general interest magazine, but yet each story they do with great research and in-depth reporting. So it is a great platform to reach a lot of people, and it allows me then to take that on the road, if you will, to do radio talk shows like this, or television, or speaking engagements to people around the world, and continue to beat that drum and raise awareness. You know, so many of the issues that I've been privileged to photograph in recent years are things that so few folks really know about. And when I tell them that 90% of the big fish in the ocean are gone, or that for every pound of shrimp that you eat in many parts of the world, 10 other pounds of animals have to die in the process, bycatch, you know, folks just don't know about that stuff. It's not on their radar. But when they become aware, they often want to change their behavior. So,
well, you have a very interesting role, too, in that you're able to educate people about these conservation issues and science through the arts.
Mm.
And that's something that I think is gaining a lot of popularity and being able to reach a greater audience. How do you feel about blending art and science?
Well, I think it's critical. And, you know, human beings are very visual creatures. And I think we respond very, very well to a still photograph or a video clip of motion picture. You know, if we think about even just since the invention of photography in sort of modern history, the last couple hundred years or more, so many of the iconic images that we remember from historic events, whether they were good events or troubling events, you know, whether it was Matthew Brady's pictures of the Civil War in the United States or man landing on the moon or the Kennedy assassination or any of these things, you know, Kent State, all these sort of pivotal moments in history, we often remember as a still frame in our mind because of a photographer who was there making that picture. And I think the conservation movement, I think, you know, nature, our planet, really needs that right now. I think we need great storytellers and great photojournalists out there. And the good thing is, you know, we're doing this at a time when it's necessary, in my opinion, but also at a time where technology has allowed us to make exciting images. You know, the cameras have gotten smaller. The cameras that I'm using these days are still photo equipment, but they can shoot great video, high-definition video. We can take great pictures with our phones. And I think because of that, people are becoming journalists every day. You know, they're out there making images and telling great stories. So it's an exciting time for technology. It's an exciting time for journalism. And it's a pivotal moment, I think, for the conservation movement to have that sort of help.
And in all the stories you've covered and people you have met, scientists, local artists, conservation leaders, what have been some of the most important lessons that have been imparted onto you through your work?
Well, you know, one of the things that I sort of keep coming back to in just recent times is that everything is connected. I'm not sure I fully even understand to what extent, but what I've learned in my 35 years or so exploring the world's oceans is that everything is dependent on each other. We've often taken an approach where we say we just need to protect the sharks, or we just need to protect this coral reef. But the truth of the matter is that from my observations, and I'm not a scientist, but spent a lot of time looking at these things, everything really needs everything else. I did a story that was in the magazine last October about the Mesoamerican reef, this world's second largest barrier reef system that goes through four countries. It goes through Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico. And Belize, I'm sorry, and Belize. And you know, I wanted the story to be about this interdependency of mangroves, seagrass beds, and coral reefs. And by spending many, many weeks, months in these ecosystems, I saw that the animals sort of ebb and flow. You know, you'll see animals on the coral reef, and then you'll see them in the seagrass beds. They're in the mangroves, certainly as a nursery, as a juvenile. And therefore, we can't just protect the coral reefs. You know, they need seagrass beds and mangroves, and everything has so – it's sort of this ecosystem approach. And I believe that we can extrapolate beyond that to the whole planet. You know, it's there are theories that the whole planet is sort of this living organism, and I can see how that might be the case. You know, people ask me when I'm doing a lecture in Kansas City or in Chicago, well, why should I care about the ocean? And my response is that, you know, three out of every four breaths that a human being takes comes from the sea. We're getting our oxygen from the plankton and the coral and all these things. So it's incumbent upon us to protect the whole planet. Certainly the ocean is a big part of that. But I guess to answer your question and come full circle here, what I have learned from working with all these scientists, all these researchers, and the things that I've seen is that everything is dependent on everything else, and we need to tread a little more lightly as we make our footprints on this planet.
And that truly is the single conservation message. I mean, everything is, especially for our Hawaii listeners today, that is an important message, because living on an island, everything here is obviously connected. And we, absolutely, you know, we talk a lot about the Mauka to Makai, the mountain to the ocean,
right,
and how what you do on land does affect the water and vice versa. And
absolutely.
So critical.
You know, my good friend Dr. Greg Stone with Conservation International, who lives on Kona now, actually, I attended a lecture that he did recently, and he quoted Buckminster Fuller, who referred to our planet as Spaceship Earth, I think back in the 1960s. And as Greg often says, you know, it is this Spaceship Earth with no chance of resupply. We have to protect what's here, because once it's gone, we've lost it. So, you know, I think the good news is that as many problems as there are, and as much sort of bad news and doom and gloom that might exist out there, there is plenty of hope. you know, the planet does have the ability to be resilient and to heal itself, and we just have to be better custodians. The ocean can heal itself, but we need to give it a chance. We need more marine protected areas. We need more places where these animals are left alone and can replenish the rest of the ocean. You know, we're not saying you shouldn't fish or you shouldn't eat seafood, but we're saying that, you know, we have to do it in a wise way. You know, the message of the elders, you know, Jane Goodall points out that in villages where she began working in Africa many years ago, she would see the elders come together before any decision was made and think about how their decisions were going to affect their people generations in the future. I don't think we do that so much today in this, quote, civilized world. I think we think about how it's going to affect us today and tomorrow, but we're not really looking into the future. So it's not rocket science. It's not difficult, and I think we just have to go back. So I think the Hawaiian culture is probably a great example of how that was done in the past and how it can be done in the future.
And that's an amazing message of hope. And let's keep that hope with our listeners, and we'll be back. We're going to a traffic break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes with Brian Skeery. Jeff Davis is on the air, and before our traffic break, Jeff is going to talk. Jeff, are you online?
Oh, Jeff is going to talk.
Sorry, we were going to go to a commercial break there.
I'm going to talk. All right. You guys, I'm amazed. Mr. Skeery, aloha. Thank you for coming on the show.
Aloha. Thank you.
Well, great timing. You know, Carly, I'm so excited. We are so lucky what you and I and our listeners get exposed to. Do you realize in the last short period of time we've had this world-renowned photographer. Another one's name is marine biologist Terry Lilly from Kauai. We've had Bryce Burke from Kona. Do you know Bryce?
I do know Bryce. He's a great friend and a wonderful videographer.
Incredible stuff. And, of course, Terry Lilly, one of the largest collections of underwater videos in the world. Dr. Greta Abbey, you work with her, Carly. And, of course, Dr. Theory work from the U.S. Geological Survey. All these people get to give us an education. And I think we're just blessed to be at the center of this, where you and I get to rub up against these folks. What do you think?
Yes, I definitely feel very lucky to be able to do this.
You know, I don't know if Mr. Spear realizes it, but all those folks I just mentioned and myself, we went snorkeling with Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard 3 weeks ago now. On the Honolulu wetland issue and the coral disease over there. Mm. I'm sure he's heard something about that.
Yeah.
And, of course, Hawaii is, you know, the poster child for just about everything positive in the world. Thanks for coming. How long are you going to be in town?
Well, I'm going to be here in Oahu for just a few more days, and then I'm going to be over in Kona for probably about another week and a half. So, it's been wonderful.
Now, Carly, thank you very much. Great job. I want everybody out there to say, you know, happy 4th of July. I hope you have a great one. I personally am headed to the Kalapana concert tomorrow. Do you know who Kalapana is, Carly?
I do, yes.
Well, they're having a concert on the lawn at the Hilton. So you get to go down there. They got Justin Young. He was my guest last week playing music. And they got a great lineup. It's like $20 for a ticket, you know. It's right there for the fireworks. I'm headed to the Hilton tomorrow for 4th of July. And I just love Kalapana. Thank God they're coming back on. How about you, Carly? What are you doing for the 4th?
I'm actually going to just take it easy, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
But enjoy the concert.
I want to remind everybody, Carly, that this show is not information and education for education's sake. This show, from where I've done everything in my power to do, is about education in order to have fun, in order to have a mohawk. And you can throw all the books in the aloha. If you're not having fun and you're not passionate about life, what good is it? So. All of you out there, have a great 4th of July. Hug your cakeys, take care of each other, and cherish each other. And aloha from the Solar Guy, Jeff Davis. Thank you, Carly.
Thanks, Jeff.
Seven 760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Out on the leeward coast, got an accident on Farrington Highway at Lehoku Street. That's near the Waianae Mall. If you're going west from town, the H1 slows at the Hickam Curve. The Moana Lewis Freeway slows right after you go under Middle Street. Inbound traffic from the west slows on either the H1 or the Moana Lua as you approach the Middle Street merge. And from there, it's going to be a slow ride to the Punahou exit. No problems to Hawaii Kai or the Windward side.
Aloha. It's your solar guy, Jeff Davis, with a sure bet for you and your family. If you or someone you know believes they are living in a neighborhood that has no room on the grid to install more photovoltaics to erase your electricity bill, I can do it. I will guarantee to get your home approved by HECO, or I'll give you $100. Again, if you need PV on your home and you're under the impression that your neighborhood or your grid is full to saturation, I, Jeff Davis, the solar guy, can get your home installed and connected to HECO's net metering program, or I'll give you a $100 call-up bill. You just call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200, 554-7200. Aloha.
If you're unhappy with the high prices or the way you've been treated by mainland corporations, get rid of them. Let Hank's Tax Service help you. Hank and his employees have been preparing taxes in Hawaii for close to 20 years. The sharpest preparers from Hank's 2 decades of unparalleled tax service have rejoined him to serve you, not make money for a mainland corporation. If you're paying over $200, you're paying way too much. Get rid of that mainland corporation and come to Hank's. Hank's Tax Service, 853-1170. 853-1170.
Want to go green for your home or business? Hawaii Community Reinvestment Corporation introduces its new Green Sun Hawaii program, an innovative public-private partnership to make energy improvements affordable for everyone. Green Sun Hawaii gives you the power to significantly reduce your utility bill. Visit Hawaii National Bank or other participating lenders or one of the many authorized energy contractors for more information. Or visit greensunhawaii.com and click on the easy-to-use loan application.
Aloha! This is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. The solar industry has changed enormously in the last 3 years. So many companies have entered the market that one of the most asked questions I hear is, what makes your company different? Solar Services Hawaii has been serving Oahu and neighbor islands for more than 20 years. Solar Services was awarded the best inspection rate statewide from the Hot Water Rebate Program. We were number one. Solar Services is a local family company. We recognize the need for service with Aloha. I personally have given a class for the IRS. I've lectured many, including 2 luncheons with the National Association of Tax Preparers. Roof penetration and tax issues are my focus. For all solar products, meaning hot water, photovoltaic, pool and spa heating, solar pool pumps, solar attic fans, you name it. We specialize in photovoltaics and hot water, and of course a free estimate is available. Just call my phone, Jeff Davis, the solar guy, at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. You have a great day and aloha.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
And now back to someone who's kind of a big deal. Brian Scarry, National Geographic underwater photojournalist. Brian, we've been picking your brain about everything you do, from conservation to arts to Nat Geo. You've published quite a few books, including Ocean Soul recently, and obviously published quite frequently articles in National Geographic. What do you prefer, book or magazine?
You know, there would be no books if it wasn't for the magazine articles. So, you know, but they're both so different. I don't know that I could say. I love the pace of working on a story for the magazine. You know, these days I typically get somewhere between 12 and 15 weeks of field time, and I try to divide that up, and I'm out there really working hard to try to get those images. The beauty of doing a book is that, you know, every few years, once you've sort of amassed this collection of images, you can then sit down and pick out your favorite pictures. And the beauty of the book is that I can write as well. I don't write for the magazine. I just do the pictures. So I'm not sure that I have a favorite. And you know, as I say, it's very important to understand that there would be no book if it wasn't for the magazine assignments. But both are very different sort of animals. And I think the book somewhat lasts a little bit longer. It has maybe a longer shelf life and stands the test of time. That being said, National Geographic is one of those magazines that few people throw away, so you can find them kicking around for years after the fact as well. So I'm dodging your question, but they're both something I like working on.
Well, I think you make an interesting point that a lot of people don't throw Nat Geos away, and I mean, my family's a bit of a pack rat, but we still had Nat Geos from like the 70s in our basement, and they're still relevant. You're still interested in the stories.
It's really fun to go back. I do the same thing, and I've got, you know, decades worth of Geographics in my attic as well. I think a lot of people's attics are sagging because of that magazine. But yeah, it's true. You know, it's fun to go back and look at what the ocean issues, for example, because that's something I'm interested in. I go back in the 1960s or 70s and see what those folks were talking about back then and look at the photography and look how far things have come. But it's very engaging, and it was always sort of the cutting edge for whatever time it was. So it's fun to go back and look.
Are there any Nat Geo photographers or journalists from the past that have inspired you in the work you do in present day?
Oh, absolutely. You know, absolutely. Certainly the underwater guys, I was very inspired by, you know, people like Louis Martin and David Dubilet, who I work with, you know, and Bates Little Hales. And some of these early photographers, Bill Kretzinger was one of my great idols. He did a number of stories here in Hawaii over his career and was a real pioneer. He was the guy that actually got me into National Geographic, you know, 15, 16 years ago. But also, yeah, exactly. Thank you, Bill. Yeah. But you know, I'm also greatly inspired by so many other photographers, many of my colleagues that are working today that are doing, you know, terrestrial stories, the wildlife guys, Nick Nichols, who's, you know, doing great stuff in Africa and these giant tree stories and really pushing the boundaries. My friend Steve Winter, who does a lot of big cat stories, snow leopards and jaguars and tigers and things like that. So I learn and get great inspiration from them, even though they're not doing anything to do with the ocean. That's really where I'm looking, because they're often leading the way in terms of technology and just pushing the boundaries.
Well, and I think you do the same for present day generation. I mean, as someone who is really interested in both underwater and photography, I mean, I definitely respect a lot of what you do, and I know many others do as well. You mentioned earlier that you have an exhibit coming up at the Smithsonian Natural History Museum, and that's definitely a place where some people can view your work. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm very excited actually about that, Carly. The exhibit will open this fall in September, and it's going to run for the better part of 2 years, which is a wonderful thing for me. I'm thrilled about it. It's a one-man show. It's called Portraits of an Ocean Planet, and the Smithsonian folks have designed this very creative exhibit that will incorporate a number of my pictures, a number of my images in sort of a conservation theme. And there's a lot of education, of course, because it is the Smithsonian, but it'll be entertaining. It should be sort of fun. And I think there'll be some opening events in September, but it will go on after that. And then there's a sort of a crowd-curated portion of that as well, where we posted a number of pictures online and allowed people to sort of vote as to what their favorite pictures were. So the last four or five images in the exhibit were actually selected by the audience, by the people that went on the web and did this. And they will also have this ongoing portion of the exhibit where people will submit their own photos, and I'll help judge that, and we'll have those on a video screen. So people will be able to have their photos part of this exhibit as well. So, yeah, it should be fun.
That's a very cool thing. And just in our last few minutes here, what last message would you like to give to our listeners, or any advice you'd give for those budding underwater photojournalists?
Oh, well, you know, I would say that if you're interested in doing this kind of work, keep the passion. Never give up. You know, it's not easy, but if you love it and you care about it, just find a way. Come up with a strategy that will work for you, and try to get from where you are today to where you want to be by developing a strategy. But keep the passion, keep the love, and don't quit.
That should be a Beatles song.
Well, we could write one.
Well, the passion is definitely evident in your work, Brian. Thank you so much for being with us here today. It has been an absolute pleasure to chat with you, and an honor to get to know you. Today's show has been made possible by the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and Hawaii's COSI program, Island Earth. COSI stands for Centers for Ocean Science and Education Excellence and aims to connect marine science issues with both visitor and local communities. Visit us online at www.cosi-ie.net. I'd also like to give a very special thank you to Jeff Davis and all the staff here that help us out on the program. I'm Carly Weiner. Thanks for listening. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.